Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Thanks for joining this conversation about the constitutional and policy questions raised by the FDA's recent crackdown on direct-to-consumer drug ads. As always, our usual disclaimer applies. The Federalist Society does not take policy positions, and all views expressed in this session belong to our speakers. Toward the end of the webinar, we'll take questions from the audience. You can use the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen in Zoom to ask a question. Now I'm pleased to introduce our distinguished moderator. Dan Troy is the Managing Director at Berkeley Research Group. He's had a storied career in the healthcare industry in both the private and public sectors. He served as chief counsel for the FDA, as well as in executive positions at Valo Health and GlaxoSmithKline. Dan also practiced law at Sidley Austin. He holds a BS in industrial and labor relations from Cornell University and a JD from Columbia Law School. Dan, please take it away.
Well, thank you. And I'm so honored to be here with the Federal Society and with my two panelists for a, very stimulating discussion about a very timely and interesting topic. So Paul Avalar, who's going to speak first, is the managing director, managing attorney at the Institute for Justice's Arizona office. He's been at the Institute for Justice, which, if you don't know, it does amazing work. Since March 2010, he litigates, among other things, free speech, property rights, economic liberty, school choice, and other constitutional cases in federal and state courts. Among the things he's been doing is been standing up against incredibly unnecessary licensing burdens that so many states adopt, for example, and with respect to cosmetologists and hair braiding, various other things. But in his free speech work, he's challenged many laws that seek to trample and override First Amendment rights. And he's co-authored the most comprehensive published study of economic liberty protections in the Arizona Constitution. He was an attorney in Philadelphia, clerk for Judge Roger Miner in the Second Circuit, Justice Andrew Hurwitz in the Arizona Supreme Court, and Judge Daniel Barker in the Arizona Court of Appeals. He's a graduate from the Arizona State University College of Law and has his undergraduate degree from Princeton. Jeff Steyer is a senior fellow at quite a number of think tanks, including the Heartland Institute. He's often widely quoted in the media and has written health policy op-eds for too many journals to mention, but including the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, the USA Today, New York Post, Washington Examiner, New York Times, et cetera. He's testified throughout state and local legislatures on FDA scientific hearings and at the Office of Management and Budget. He's been an voice for freedom at hearings at the United Nations and in Israel's Knesset. He crafted health and environmental policy in the office of the mayor during the Giuliani administration in New York City. He serves on the boards of many new nonprofit Jewish International Connections and Park City Jewish Collective. He earned his law degree from the Cardozo School of Law, served two terms as editor-in-chief of the Cardozo Law Forum, and he supports survivors and first responders. So first, we're going to have Paul explain the sort of constitutional background that you really need to understand in order to understand this issue. And then Jeff will dive into the desires of the current administration and the challenges that those should face. So Paul, why don't you take it away and start?
Thank you, Dan. So the topic today really is about commercial speech. And for those of you who don't remember, con law from law school, commercial speech, the Supreme Court has said, is speech that does no more than propose a commercial transaction. So it clearly encompasses things like advertising for a product like we're going to be talking about today. You know, the sort of what you might call the background or common law rule prior to incorporation of the First Amendment was that advertising was protected speech so long as it was not fraudulent, not misleading, and for a lawful good or service. If it was illegal to sell cocaine, you could not advertise that you sold cocaine, that sort of thing. And that was basically the background rule until 1942. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Valentine v. Christensen, says that the First Amendment had no application, no constraint on government as respects purely commercial advertising. And why that was, I think, is never really under never really explained. It doesn't really matter much because in 1976, the Supreme Court says, oops, got that one wrong. Virginia Pharmacy Board versus Virginia Citizens Consumer Council, which is really the birth of the current modern commercial speech doctrine about advertising and whether it's protected speech or not. And what the Supreme Court says is, look, actually, this is speech that has value to consumers. In fact, in many ways, it has value to consumers in a way above and beyond political speech. Political speech is important to people mostly for purposes of voting. So that's what, once every 2 years, once every 4 years, whenever there's election. But commercial speech really has to do with the day-to-day decisions they make about themselves, about the products they consume, about what they pay for them. And so the Supreme Court says, yes, it's protected, but it's lesser protected than sort of ordinary, fully protected speech. That's fully fleshed out in a case called Central Hudson in 1980, which is where we get the Central Hudson test. That's the current test for regulations of commercial speech. So as with traditional rules, speech must be truthful, may not relate to illegal activity. But then also there's an add-on to that. Government must have a substantial interest in regulating the speech. The regulation must directly advance that interest. And the regulation must not be more extensive than is necessary. This is something like an intermediate scrutiny standard for those of you keeping score at home. The important points here, I think, for today's discussion are going to be that the government has the burden of justifying restrictions on commercial speech. That burden is a heavy one, the court has repeatedly emphasized. And the burden may not be satisfied by mere speculation or conjecture. There has to be some real evidence to back up the regulation. And so ever since then, we've seen a number of cases involving commercial speech regulations or supposedly commercial speech regulations and pharmaceutical products. So in 1983, you have a case called Bulger versus Young's Drug Corporation, which was a restriction on the mailing of unsolicited advertising of contraceptives, which the court says, no, that's unconstitutional. It's protected speech as commercial speech. And the government's supposed interests here in regulating the speech don't really work. There's, you know, an interest in protecting, you know, children from seeing this sort of thing, people who hadn't volunteered to receive this information may be offended by it. And neither one of these is substantial enough or directly is directly regulated enough to pass muster under Central Hudson. There's a 2011 case called Sorrell v. IMS Health, which I think plays in to a lot of this as well. That was a case in which Vermont tried to restrict indirectly, but was really trying to do it, commercial speech about drugs. And it was pretty clear in that case, I think even Vermont recognized, it couldn't prohibit drug companies from directly talking to physicians who prescribe medications, of course. So Vermont tried to restrict what's called prescriber identifying information, which is data maintained by insurance companies, by pharmacies, et cetera. It's anonymized information. There's no patient identifying information in there, but it's data about which physicians are writing prescriptions for which drugs. And the drug companies were using this to identify doctors who were either writing prescriptions for their drugs or not, and was using that information to approach them about in so-called detailing of their drugs. That's pharma reps coming to the doctor's offices to talk to the doctors. Vermont tried to restrict this data going to pharmaceutical companies, and the court dealt with this as a commercial speech regulation. I'm not sure that it really is. It wasn't a restriction on advertising. It was a restriction on information that strikes me as not commercial speech. But the court said even under commercial speech, this doesn't satisfy it. And I think here the big things are that the court considered the legislative findings about detailers and the use of this information and rejected that. The legislature had said, look, we're interested in medical privacy, to which the court said, well, look, you've only restricted this as to drug companies. Everyone else can still access this. That's not going to meet Central Hudson. And really the state's real interest here, and I think this is again going to play into our conversation today, is that they said, well, this is going to improve public health and reduce healthcare costs, which was a very paternalistic argument. Their argument was essentially that the physicians were too dumb to withstand this advertising by pharma companies, and therefore were writing too many prescriptions for the wrong drugs, which, by the way, Vermont is a single payer entity, was paying for. And the court said, no, look, that's not a sufficient interest on which to restrict truthful advertising to physicians. Again, not direct to consumer advertising, but again, to consumers. This sets up, I think, another interesting or important note for us to keep mind of here. We've talked about commercial speech as that being, which is not false or misleading. There's multiple kinds of misleading. There's actually or inherently misleading, and there's potentially misleading. The first is just false. The second category of stuff is true, but which may not be fully understood. And there's a case called Zouderer from 1985. It has to do with advertising by lawyers, which really gets to this and touches on another aspect, I think, which is going to be important for us today, which is going to be mandatory speech or disclosures or disclaimers that the government requires on speech. That was a case in which the law firm was advertising contingent fee legal services that said that the client would pay no legal fees, but it didn't mention that clients would not be reimbursed for court costs. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, that's literally true. That's the speech that you have engaged in is literally true. But the public may not understand the difference between legal fees and court costs. And so it's okay to require you to add a disclaimer that legal fees does not mean court costs. And so that's where that language comes from. What the court says is that allowing compelled speech to correct inherently misleading commercial advertisements is allowed so long as that compelled speech is, quote, purely factual and uncontroversial information, and that's to correct the misleading statement about the good or service at issue. The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't done a lot with Zouderer since it came down. It's been mentioned in a couple of cases like NIFLA, but never really squarely addressed. Some circuits have really taken some liberties with Zouderer, reduced it to mere rational basis review, or sort of dispensed with the requirement that it be only limited to inherently misleading speech, or taken a rather curious view of what purely factual and uncontroversial means. Some of them have done all three, the Ninth Circuit. And so that's where we live today. That's where the conversation, I think, today starts with regard to what the proposals are here with regard to direct-to-consumer advertising that is commercial speech, and it's going to be constitutionally judged against this background, which, again, has already started to deal with pharmaceutical advertising in several cases.
Great. Thank you. When we come around, we might also want to mention the Western States case. But Jeff Steyer, you want to talk to us about what the administration is proposing with respect to direct-to-consumer ads?
Yes. Thanks, Dan. And Paul, thank you. That was really a perfect distillation of kind of where the legal situation is. And as I get into what the administration is proposing, kind of a number of different avenues, I think it'll make a lot more sense to our viewers. One shortcut to understanding this issue is So delving a little bit into the direct-to-consumer advertising kind of nuts and bolts. So as we know, you can advertise pharmaceutical products, but they are regulated. They're, in fact, highly regulated. And there's this framework that explains how you can do it. And it really comes from a 1997 policy. So it's like 30 years we've been doing this. There is a government interest in making sure that consumers understand the risk of a pharmaceutical product, certainly. So the government regulates that and says, well, you have to tell consumers what those risks are. And that was a little bit burdensome. Imagine, you know, a 30-second or 1-minute spot on the evening news where you say, we're selling this medicine. It'll help you with this and that. And that's all true. But then we all are familiar with those side effects, those contraindications. So the problem before 1997 was that when you had to list all of these potential side effects, even the extremely rare ones, it became unfeasible to actually advertise. So the FDA had a policy that's often known as the adequate provision, which is, we're all familiar with this. They say, here's the medicine, here's how it'll help you. It may cause these side effects, and they'll list the major side effects, the most common ones. But if you've ever nerded out and looked at all of the potential side effects for any medication that you've ever been prescribed, you'll see it's a very, very long list. So obviously you can't do that in a 30-second or 1-minute advertising spot, or even in a little magazine spread, unless you make it really small. So what the FDA allowed was to have an adequate provision that you could make a statement of, here are what the main risks are. There are other risks, and to learn about them, visit this website or call this 800 number or even speak with your doctor. Now, let me remind you, for these medications that we're talking about very often, especially for the more controversial ones, these are not over-the-counter medications. These are prescription drugs where you can't just as a consumer say, wow, that commercial sounds like it'll solve all my problems. I'm going to go get that medication. You have to go to your doctor and you have to get a prescription for it. And obviously, it is an obligation on the doctor to discuss all of those contraindications, all of the potential side effects, to explain to you how common they are, whether you and your particular situation, whether it's an appropriate risk-benefit analysis. That has always been and is appropriately something that should be discussed between a doctor and a patient. And if that's not happening, I think we fix that problem. And certainly there are cases where it's not happening, at least not frequently enough. And certainly we've seen over the past few years with companies that are selling, you know, compounded medicines for GLP-1s, for a wide range of topics, where you see a doctor online, but some of these drug mills, prescription mills, certainly could use better oversight. That doesn't mean that it was the advertising of these drugs that was the problem. I would argue from a policy perspective is that we're not doing a good enough job making sure doctors do their job. As Paul mentioned, there is the court has recognized that there is a benefit to the consumer for advertising. And I think that's particularly obvious in this case. And I would argue it's particularly important, especially for men. And the reason for that is that many patients do not see their doctors, and I think our gender is perhaps more responsible for that than others. And what we've often seen is that when men will see an advertisement for a medication that may improve an affliction that they have, they can't just go out and get the drug. They have to go see their doctor. And very often we will find instances where you visit your doctor and say, hey, doc, I want this medicine. And the doc runs some tests and says, actually, you have a different problem. And let's deal with that. So I would argue that in many cases, direct to consumer advertising is a public health benefit paid for by the private sector. And that's very important. So if you want to know how somebody's a little shortcut, if you want to know how somebody feels about this issue, and I've talked with a lot of reporters, financial analysts, and I can tell usually in the first 10 seconds of a conversation where they fall out on this issue. And that is whether they call the adequate provision, the idea that you can put in a link to all of the side effects, is do they call that the adequate provision exemption? Or, like RFK Jr., do they call it a loophole? Because loopholes need fixing. Exemptions are quite rational and reasonable. So that's my little shortcut for you. So what did the administration do? Well, let's start with what they did before they were the administration. During the campaign, RFK Jr., who was teed up to run HHS, said, and I'm going to quote it so I don't misquote him, "On my first day in office, I will issue an executive order banning pharmaceutical advertising on television," close quote. So I think if anyone was paying attention to any of what Paul said, we know that would be unconstitutional. So that raises the issue. The litany of policy proposals put out on by the FDA back in September of last year, some of them were issuing warning letters to companies. They were stepping up enforcement of existing rules. And I think those are all fine, driven by his agenda of banning those ads, recognizing once he had a government lawyer telling him that his campaign promise was unconstitutional, he said, well, how else can I do it? And one of the things that he did through the FDA, Dr. McCarry, is he started a rulemaking that would close the adequate provision that would say you can't do that. So if you're running an advertisement on the evening news that talks about the benefits of this medication, and it's important to note, if it's just a reminder and says, hey, this drug is available, you don't have to get into it. But if you're talking about the benefits of a medication, then you have to talk about the risks. So if you just say, hey, there's a medication out there with this name, speak to your doctor, no need. However, no need to list the website with all the potential side effects. However, once you get into the potential benefits of the medication, then you have to show the flip side. And then the issue that comes up under the regulation is, for the very reason that the 1997 regulation was put into place, that it would be completely unfeasible to advertise in the evening news on television with listing all of the potential side effects, as many as they may be, just impossible to do in a 30-second ad or even a minute ad. And there's, by the way, there's data that shows that people often get overwhelmed by that. And that has two effects. One, they get overwhelmed by that and they ignore the potential side effects, which is something that they ought to be discussing with their doctor. Or also importantly, if you list all, and this is, you know, behavioral economics type of research, you list all of the risks, and the very, very rare risk might turn off a patient to taking an obvious medication that their doctor should be prescribing. And the only reason they walked into their doctor's office is because they saw the ad and they said, but doctor, I have this problem, but I don't want that medication because I heard it could cause all of these problems. And by the way, you know, one rare side effect is it could cause loss of hair, which reminds me to thank Paul for his advocacy. I speak on behalf of Dan as well, defense of hair braiding. For consumers. There are lots of side effects. They are not always relevant to certain patient groups. They are sometimes extremely rare. So what RFK Jr. would like to do, and the FDA now has proposed, is to say, we're not going to go with that adequate provision. We're going to say, if you want to advertise, there is a government interest in making sure that consumers understand the risks and benefits, and having that conversation with your physician is not sufficient, and therefore you have to list them all. So if I were asked to, let's say this rule goes into effect, it's in the rulemaking process right now, if I were asked to challenge that rule in court, the first thing I would do, other than pointing out the First Amendment, and that, as Paul pointed out, that commercial speech is protected, is point to RFK's very clear statement that it was his intent to ban these ads. That's a, you know, a rhetorical argument. I don't know whether a court will or should say that the FDA or HHS shouldn't be allowed to advance a policy proposal because what they really want to do would be unconstitutional, and therefore what they're doing is a backdoor way to achieve their unconstitutional goal. I think it's a good rhetorical argument, but I don't think it addresses the legal standard that Paul clearly laid out in terms of Central Hudson and other cases. There is a policy aspect to this as well. So when talking to reporters, I often find out that they're not, maybe excluding the ones that have joined on this webinar, is that reporters have often been confused between the legal issues and the policy issues. And you can make the legal arguments, and I think it may be a little bit of a tougher case than Dan laid out in briefly in his introduction. It may be a tough case. I could make, I think, a good argument that the government would not be unlawfully reining in commercial speech in this instance by requiring a full list, even if it makes it unfeasible. You could argue, well, maybe they need to spend more money, buy a longer ad, or maybe it's not the right venue because consumers, they could argue, are being misled. So I think there's a case to be made that the government does have a legal right to do it under the current law. However, there is the policy argument. And I personally would argue that direct-to-consumer advertising, historically, especially since the law, the rules have been changed in almost 30 years ago, is that it has been a boon to public health in that it gets patients in the door to see their doctor, which is a real public health problem that patients aren't doing that enough. But if you look at RFK Jr.'s and Dr. Makary's arguments, they say that it's not only because consumers are being misled and therefore we need the full risk. He has argued, and he did this during the campaign as well as beyond that, that, and this really goes to, I think, his ideological approach, which he's entitled to, and I think the executive branch is appropriately making those judgments, even if I disagree with them, is that the direct-to-consumer advertising leads to what he calls over-medicalization. You know, RFK and Maha, they want everyone to eat a perfect diet and exercise the right amount, and we won't have any health problems. Well, he says, well, people see all these advertisements and say, I don't need to do anything. I can just take the medication. And that's his prerogative. He may be wrong on that, but from a policy perspective, I think he's entitled to make that argument. And Dan and I and others are welcome to challenge them. He says it leads to unnecessary prescriptions. That goes back to what I said earlier, that it's really appropriate for the doctor and the patient to decide that. It's not as if these patients are seeing ads and going out and get prescription drugs on their own, or if they are, by going to some prescription mill. I think the crackdown ought to take place on the prescription mill, not on the commercial speech that is otherwise protected, and not only protected, that is a real benefit to the consumer, is a real benefit to the patient, because it does get them to the doctor. And RFK also said that it contributed to our chronic disease epidemic and that it contributes to the high cost of drugs. Well, you don't need to be an economist to understand that if you're a pharmaceutical company spending millions of dollars on advertising, you're not doing it for the goal of raising the cost of the drug. You're doing it to get more of the appropriate patients on the drug, which spreads the cost of the very high research and development costs that it takes to bring drugs to market. So this is an issue that we should not look at in a vacuum. Rather, as the administration and Congress look to lower the cost of prescription drugs, which I think is an admirable goal. The question is, how do you do that? Well, I think if you just look at it economically and you say, well, if we can get this medication to more of the patients who appropriately need that medication, we can spread out that cost more broadly. And that would, of course, have the effect of lowering the price of drugs, not increasing the price of drugs. So when it comes to the Central Hudson case and the test, these policy arguments, I believe, are going to really be the ones. Does the government meet the high standard that it has, the burden, to show that they have an appropriate public interest in that? And as Paul said earlier, so they could have that policy view, but do they meet the test? Excuse me, do they have the evidence that these policies will achieve the policy outcome? I think that becomes a much more challenging issue for the government. So there are important legal issues here. There are important policy issues. And I think as the administration will be forced to defend its policy goal of eliminating direct-to-consumer advertising, doing it in a way that its attorneys have said might be legal, they will still have the obligation to show a court that they have evidence that it will work. There is going to be equal or perhaps more evidence on the other side that it doesn't increase the cost of drugs, rather it lowers them by spreading it out, that it doesn't lead to over-medicalization because doctors have to have that conversation with their patients and we can crack down elsewhere. So a lot of the arguments the government raises really go back to, I think, the RFK underlying ideology is that we are an over-medicalized society. The drug companies are evil. They're out to make money off the backs of consumers, and therefore we have to rein them in. We can't do it by banning ads as RFK had wanted to. So this is a different way of achieving the same outcome. So just because he wanted to ban the ads doesn't mean that the effort to regulate them in the way that he wants to by listing all the medication, all the side effects in a 30-second ad is therefore unconstitutional. But we have to go back to, will they meet the central Hudson standard? Will the government be able to show that the evidence that banning these ads, or effectively banning these ads, right? It's not going to be a ban on the ads, but it makes it completely unfeasible in many cases to reach the consumer broadly, is will the government meet that traditional central Hudson burden?
Great, excellent. Thank you, Jeff. One clarification. Have they actually come out with an NPRM? I know they announced an intention to do an NPRM, but I don't think they've yet come out with one. Am I wrong about that?
No, I don't think you're wrong about it, but clearly it's the intention is to regulate this.
No, they have said that. They have definitely said that, but I haven't seen the NPRM yet. So Paul, any comments on what Jeff said? And in particular, one of the things that the FDA did do in September of 2025 when they announced an intention to do this NPRM is they sent letters to thousands of drug sponsors and about 100 cease and desist letters to companies with ostensibly, allegedly deceptive ads. Any thoughts about that step up in enforcement and whether we've seen it have real effect in the real world?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, there's a couple wrinkles here. One is that FDA can't regulate medical practice. What it does is it regulates the selling, the approval and selling of drugs. So the FDA can't, to the best of my knowledge, like go after doctors for prescribing the wrong drugs or prescribing too much of them or whatever. That's dealt with on a state by state by state basis. So the big thing that struck me, and I'm not an expert in the pharmaceutical field, and specifically with what they're doing here, more just sort of a background guy, but it strikes me, having now read some of this stuff, that the government's motivating purpose here is the same as in so many of the other commercial speech cases, which is a variation of paternalism. It's a concern that people will act badly if given truthful information. And you can see that across, I think, a number of the cases that I talked about earlier with VA pharmacy. There was a concern that people would flock to the lowest price pharmaceutical or pharmacies and bypass things like professionalism. Oh, it was licensed pharmacists who were making that argument so that they could be anti-competitive, but let's set that aside. Bulger was avowed suppressing truthful advertising about contraceptives because the government thought contraceptives were immoral, and I don't think wanted people to use them. Sorrell was about suppressing raw information because the government didn't like that drug companies could use it to inform doctors and cause doctors to prescribe more name brand drugs as opposed to cheaper generics or maybe none at all. starting to sound a little familiar. And even in the non-pharma cases, you get this you get this real paternalism too. 44 Liquor Mart, which is a fun case about advertising the cost of alcohol. The government was flat out and saying, look, we want to suppress truthful information about low prices on alcohol to prevent people from drinking because we don't like alcohol. Well, fine, but there are more direct ways of getting people to not drink than suppressing truthful information. Central Hudson itself is a case about suppressing truthful information in order to, in that case, it was to prevent unnecessary growth in the use of electricity because the government had so mismanaged the grid that there was not enough electrical sources, enough generation capacity. So this is a pretty common, I think, theme through all of these commercial speech cases, which is government's concern is, I think, less that the speech itself is not truthful and more that they are concerned about the way people are acting on that truthful information. And the court's never really been a big fan of that sort of argument.
Paul, can I push back on that? You know, here at the Federalist Society, we like presenting both sides. The paternalism argument you make, I think, is on point. But can you refine what you just said? Is that a policy argument you're making, or is it a legal argument you're making?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, certainly maybe it's a good government policy to be paternalistic. I'm just not sure that from a First Amendment doctrine standpoint, I don't think the U.S. Supreme Court has embraced paternalism as a good motivating factor. In a number of these cases, the court has said, well, look, there's a legitimate enough concern here. In some of these cases, they've said, look, there's a potentially legitimate concern here. You have a legitimate interest in making sure that doctors are writing appropriate scripts. But the way you're going about it in suppressing truthful information is a bad way of doing it. So paternalism itself is not like, oh, this is paternalistic, therefore it's unconstitutional. But I don't think the government the Supreme Court takes a bright view of paternalism as a motivator for suppressing speech.
So how would you respond to RFK's argument that we're not suppressing speech? My lawyers told me we can't do that. We're just making sure that consumers have access to all of the information in the very...
Right. So he's actually making a Zouderer argument. What he's saying is not so much that the information that's out there is false or misleading, but it's not that it's not legitimate, like literally untrue. It's just it's leaving potentially consumers with a false understanding of what's going on. That's why we have to require them to provide more information. That's strictly speaking a Zouderer kind of argument. So the way this is framed up, it's not a we can stop you from advertising. It's a if you want to advertise, you have to include all of this additional information. So I really think that we're talking about Zouderer land here as opposed to a more traditional sort of we can stop you from saying these things perspective. And as I said, Zouderer is really, I think, unsettled in the district courts. So I don't know how that's going to play out at the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems that Zouderer has some exacting requirements. I'm not sure how this one will, without all the details, I'm not sure how this one would shake out.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, my sense is that Zouderer does not go so far as to allow what would be essentially a de facto ban, right? Because the way it was before the adequate provision exemption, it was a de facto ban. I mean, it was, you know, it could be easy to demonstrate that it was absolutely impractical for any pharmaceutical company to advertise on television. And so they didn't. But we have a very interesting question from the audience, which really does reflect kind of the Maha perspective. And it's that the DTC ads aren't they, or this is a concern, you know, effectively legalized bribery to prevent media investigations into pharmaceutical company misconducts. Drug companies pay very large amounts of money to news outlets every year for the drug ads. And as a result, those news outlets pull their punches when it comes to reporting on drug company misconduct. So I'd be interested in, you guys addressing that concern, and you know, looking at that from sort of, you know, the constitutional lens, would that change the First Amendment calculus? Jeff, you look like you really want to address this.
I don't think it would change the calculus. I mean, it's a good political argument. I don't think it's a solid legal argument. I could point to endless negative reporting on the evening news about pharmaceutical companies and how evil they are. I think the question that we got is there is something to it. You do see a lot of advertising on the evening news about pharmaceutical products, but especially on the free networks. But I think if you look at the viewership of the evening news, you don't see a lot of young, healthy people watching those broadcasts. You see a lot of senior citizens who are the target of these medical pharmaceutical advertisements. So I think it's a great rhetorical argument. I don't think it carries much political, policy, or legal weight.
Paul, any comment on that?
Yeah, I think go back to Central Hudson and the last two factors, that the regulation must directly advance that interest and must not be more extensive than necessary. And it seems to me you're going to flounder on a complete ban on both of those prongs, even if you assume everything, even if you assume the government can meet the rest of the requirements. A complete ban on speech is... it's going to require a quite the showing by the government. And the proposal here isn't based on direct evidence. It's based on supposition and some not conspiracy theory, but like the idea here is that we're assuming that this is true. And the U.S. Supreme Court has been very clear the government can't meet its burden with that. There has to be real evidence in order to justify a restriction.
Yeah, I mean, the example that I think people from AHA cite is the underreporting with respect to the side effects of the COVID vaccine, which is absolutely the case. But, you know, my own take, we'd love to hear what you guys think, is that it wasn't a bribe that was paid to the companies. It's that almost all of the relevant powerful stakeholders had an interest in not publicizing that information. So Pfizer didn't publicize it. Moderna didn't publicize it. The CDC didn't publicize it. People who wanted everybody to get the shots didn't publicize it. And elite opinion wanted everybody to get the shots. And so there was absolutely underreporting about the side effects of the COVID vaccine, which is not to say they weren't severely effective and they, you know, a great, great, great boon to the public health, which I think they were. But nonetheless, there was that. But the idea that it's because there were DTC ads seems to me to be quite the stretch.
Yeah, I would agree that even if there were no DTC ads, we would have still had the same underreporting of those side effects.
Yeah. Do either of you have a view on another proposal that is often floated with respect to DTC ads, which is to end its tax deductibility? And by the way, I should just clarify, when I'm talking about direct-to-consumer ads, I'm only, and you kind of touched on this, Jeff, I'm only talking about advertising on television, radio, et cetera, of prescription drug products, because over-the-counter drug advertising, I think all of you who've watched TV know, doesn't have all of the same, you know, required bells and whistles, all of the risks. And in fact, it's not even regulated by the FDA. The Federal Trade Commission actually regulates drug advertising for over-the-counter drugs like, you know, Bayer aspirin or Advil or whatever. So DTC ads to me only speak to prescription drug products.
Now, on that point, I'll throw a little bone to RFK. I would argue that Tylenol over the counter is a pretty dangerous drug. And most people who will see an FTC regulated advertisement about Tylenol probably aren't aware of how dangerous Tylenol is. And it might not even be approved by the FDA today.
And obviously, Tylenol is enduring lots of litigation on that issue, which is orthogonal, but relevant.
Dan, on your question, advertising is generally, as a tax write-off, it's generally a business expense, which is,
yes, it is
deductible. It seems that if the government is going to restrict what kind of business expenses you can actually deduct based on the fact that it is speech is also going to raise some real problems. I mean, the court has already, and I think repeatedly, struck down special taxes on speech and said, no, that's a no-go. Again, how that will fit under a commercial speech regulation when, again, what they're not really regulating the speech. What they're saying is that you can't deduct this because it's speech and inherently because we don't like it. I'm not sure, again, that will work very well. And I don't know that we would want it to work very well given the government's ability to tax basically anything and then create special exemptions for things that it likes versus not.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, it's a real problem if it's that includes go ahead, speech.
Jeff.
Yeah, I think if there were, say, an additional tax deduction because somebody from the administration heard what I just said, that direct-to-consumer advertising is a boon to public health, and the government created an additional incentive to do it, and then they wanted to take away that incentive, well, that would be different than not giving it the same deduction that every other business expense would get, as Paul said.
Right. So my take on it is that it would not be content neutral, right? I mean, if you're going particularly after only DTC ads and not ads for Tylenol and not ads for breakfast cereals, that would be a problem. Now, I think if Congress said, we're just getting rid of tax deductibility for all advertising, I think that would probably pass muster because it's hard to argue that that's not viewpoint neutral or content neutral, but particularly targeting DTC ads, I think there's a fair number of cases that would say that's not viewpoint neutral, it's not content neutral, and you can't use the tax code to penalize the kind of speech that you disfavor.
Well, I'm not sure it would be content. I don't think it would be content neutral. I mean, it's still.
No, it's not content neutral.
It would be content based. It may not be viewpoint based, but it would still be content based. It's advertising.
So I was saying it's not content neutral. Yes, yeah, so yeah. Agreeing it's content based. I think it's actually viewpoint based and not viewpoint neutral as well, because you're particularly targeting ads that are for pharmaceutical products. And I mean, people don't really run ads against drug products, but certainly the plaintiff's bar, you know, says very, very, very disparaging things about prescription medicines in many of its ads, including those that run on, you know, the national news.
I mean, that's one of the things about the commercial speech doctrine is that it's inherently content-based and speaker-based. It's just in a way that doesn't trigger the sort of traditional regulations. If I sit here and tell you I think drug so-and-so is excellent for treating condition Y, first of all, I'm not a doctor, no one's going to care, but that's not commercial speech. I have not engaged in commercial speech by giving you my opinion on whether some drug is good or not. It's if the drug company or someone associated with the drug company, the manufacturer, gives you that information, then it's commercial speech because it's advertising and that sort of thing. So all of this is, again, this is commercial speech is one of those areas in which the sort of the traditional rules don't quite apply because of the content. But yeah, if you sort of take another step back, commercial speech is inherently a content and speaker-based regulation of speech.
Yeah, although the interesting thing here is that, as you started out by saying rightly, Paul, it's speech that proposes a commercial transaction, but actually the consumer can't go out and buy the drug, right? The best the consumer can do is can ask the doctor to prescribe the medicine. So it's a pretty indirect way of proposing a commercial transaction. I still think you're right that it would be characterized as commercial speech because it's advertising, but it's very different than almost any other kind of traditional ad.
I would argue that if the FDA does introduce this rule, and if it gets through the rulemaking process and becomes the law of the land, and this were challenged, I would say that this that hypothetical case, would turn out differently if it weren't for the fact. I mean, I think the government can make some arguments that it leads to over-medicalization. I think it could argue that it leads to higher drug prices and that we're in a kind of an ad war that does increase prices. I disagree with those arguments, but they can make them and they have some evidence for them. But I think this case would turn on the fact that you, even though it is direct to consumer advertising, as you both have said, the consumer can't act on that. they can just go to their doctor and ask for the prescription. And it's really on the doctor to have that conversation. If you could, and to the extent that there are companies out there that are taking advantage of, you know, setting up an online, and I'm all for online medicine, but there are certainly companies abusing it that will get you on the phone or a video with a doctor and give you the drug without doing an exam. I think that type of abuse needs to be cracked down upon, and it would do a very poor job of weighing the risks and the benefits of the regulation if they just said, we don't want any of this advertising, therefore you have to list all of the potential side effects, therefore making it pre-1997 where there are no such ads. And I think that would be a bad policy outcome. And I think the court would see it not only as bad policy, but as an effort to end run the Constitution.
Yeah. So, I mean, what people often don't know is that what happened to lead to the 1997 adequate provision rule was GlaxoSmithKline, which I later became the general counsel of, but I had no involvement with the company at this point. The GSK went to FDA and threatened First Amendment litigation if they didn't create this kind of pathway for direct-to-consumer ads, because they argued, I think pretty persuasively, that it was a de facto ban. And FDA Commissioner Kessler was inalterably opposed to this. And the guidance, the draft guidance from 97, came out basically 1 week after he left the agency. And then it was finalized in 99. And ever since then, we've had DTC ads for better or worse. Jeff, I want to sort of throw a little bit of a curveball. My brother, Debbie Troy, who's been the deputy secretary of HHS and who's very pro-pharma and has written, he has a lead, you know, front page story of commentary defending the pharmaceutical sector. He argues that DTC ads have been extremely harmful for the pharmaceutical sector, and that they shouldn't engage in them because they invite a political backlash. I've of course taken the other, you know, point of view of that, having been at a pharma company and understanding why we did them, and actually having been at FDA, where, as you say, FDA initially was sort of opposed to DTC ads, and they only were created this pathway at sufferance, but came around because they found that DTC ads did engender, Jeff, as you say, sort of discussion of what a CEO I used to work for called, you know, below the belt indications. So people are much more willing to come in and say, doctor, can you give me Viagra, rather than, doctor, I have, you know, this condition. Or same thing with genital warts. They'd rather come in and say, doctor, I need Valtrex, than say, doctor, I have genital warts. So yeah. Jeff, on the sort of policy, pragmatic, political question of whether DTC ads have been good or bad for the industry.
Yeah, well, I'll take that curveball and say it's outside the strike zone with regard to this case. Yeah. Only because you could agree with Tevi, who I respect greatly, and say, yeah, it is bad for the pharmaceuticals. And that's a decision that the pharmaceutical companies on a case-by-case basis should make on their own. It's certainly not something the government should make. So that's kind of why it's outside the strike zone. But I'll take a swing nonetheless. And say that it is probably not a one-size-fits-all thing, right? Do you want to spend your advertising budget to get a medication to consumers or to get them to go see their doctors? It depends on the medication. It depends on the awareness. It depends on the size. On the flip side, it depends on the backlash. So, you know, sometimes you may want to swing at a pitch outside the strike zone, but sometimes, depending on the circumstances, you may say it's not appropriate in this case. So I think look, I respect Tevi enough to know that there are going to be circumstances where he's right, but I don't think you can make a across the board, hey, DTC ads are bad because of the backlash. Is there backlash? Well, look at RFK and many other Democrats are against DTC advertising. If you have a more libertarian, less paternalistic crowd, like perhaps those of us here, we recognize the benefits of those ads, and maybe the benefits of those ads outweigh whatever political backlash they cause. Absolutely. There are politicians, regulators, public health groups like Public Citizen. I don't know their position on DTC advertising, but I imagine the Ralph Naders of the world would like to see this regulation introduced and passed. I know many doctors who hate DTC advertising because patients come in and say, doctor, give me this medication. It'll solve this problem. And they're way off base. So there are lots of arguments, Tevi's and others, that raise issues with DTC advertising, and I'm not going to dismiss them out of hand. However, when it comes to whether these advertisements should be allowed, whether there is a benefit to them, certainly there is.
Yeah. Paul, any comments?
I mean, I go back to, I'm just a simple constitutional lawyer here. I go back to what the court talked about in Central Hudson, which is, or the Central Hudson test, which I'm not necessarily a huge fan of, but it does provide a useful framework for thinking about this. I think the most important question in all of this is the speech truthful or is it misleading? If it's misleading, then yes, it can be regulated in order to ensure that people are not being misled. And, you know, traditionally fraud is outside of the First Amendment entirely. So this begins to make a lot of sense. It's in line with the standard, you know, even pre-commercial speech doctrine rules on this, pre-Valentine rules on this. So I think that's the most important question to answer. Once you have that question answered, then you can go through the checklist of, okay, what's the government really requiring here? How burdensome is this? How much is this just sort of a disagreement in outcomes versus actual misleading? Are we not regulating speech more broadly than we have to in order to accomplish this important goal of making sure that the public is adequately informed, truthfully informed about the spectrum of choices they need to make? And so that's the analysis here. And so it will depend on, well, what's the pharma company saying? What are the benefits and burdens here? What has the government shown with regard to the public really being misled or not, not just assuming the public is misled? And I don't think it's enough to say, well, look, we think the public is misled because we don't like the way they're acting on the information. It has to be something more than just that sort of, again, paternalistic urge to stop people from doing things because they have truthful information.
Yeah. So I'll note that in the FTC context and in the Lanham Act context, if you want to demonstrate that something is misleading, normally the one seeking to restrict the speech has the burden of coming forward and showing that consumers actually perceive it as misleading with basically consumer survey evidence, which is, you know, very often deployed in the FTC and in the Lanham Act context, unless, as you said earlier, Paul, you're making a literal falsity argument and you can show to a judge that there's no way that this is in any way, shape or form truthful. It is just, you know, on its face misleading. When I was FDA chief counsel, I couldn't insist that we do a consumer survey for every letter that we sent out against direct-to-consumer ads, but I did insist that that at the time it was division, the DDMAC, the Division of Drug Marketing and Advertising and Communications, now it's called OPDP, that they dictate a memo to the file from someone who had a PhD in consumer science articulating why they believed that this ad was misleading. So that at least the government was making some kind of showing. Not that we made those ads public, those memos public, but that at least, you know, we felt that there was some kind of evidence base for, you know, showing by a preponderance of the evidence that this was more misleading than not.
Right. And Zouderer, consistent with the commercial speech doctrine, puts the burden on the government. Again, the Supreme Court has already said for purposes of commercial speech, the government bears the burden of justifying restrictions or, in Zouderer, the required speech. That burden is a heavy one. They keep saying that. And they keep saying that it can't be satisfied by speculation or conjecture. There has to be, maybe it's not a full-blown consumer survey, but there has to be some there in order for there to be a regulation.
Now that is, I think, a perfect note on which to perhaps end, because I see that Elizabeth is coming on in order to basically march us off.
Yes, well, thank you to Dan, to Paul, and to Jeff for sharing their time and expertise with us this afternoon. And thanks to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fed-soc.org. Thanks again for joining, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.